John
We're
here.
Back.
Whoa, you startled me, man. That was good.
I got tired of waiting.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, usually I do the whole like, this is my co-host, and now you're not gonna say anything. Okay, that's good. All right, cool. All right, it's gonna be one of those episodes. I see. Well, my name is John Simon, and this is my good friend Thomas Duwell, whose name I'm just gonna say for him.
Thank you.
And this is Church History for Chumps, the chumpiest church history podcast on the internet. How's that for a tagline?
We really are, though. I think it's pretty good. Sometimes I listen to other podcasts and I'm like, you think you're better than us.
Like, I just imagine, like if they challenged us to, like, a history, like, trivia show, we'd get demolished.
I think that we know more niche stuff.
Yeah.
Like, I think that, like, the whole, like, 5 minutes in church history dude doesn't know about Takashi Nagai.
I doubt he does. Yeah. He knows 5 minutes of stuff at a time. We have never released a 5 minute episode. And we never will. Darn it.
We're going to have we'll have to have a podcast showdown one of these days. Like a March Madness style.
Yeah, that's good. But also, if that dude from 5 minutes of church history ever wants to.
He definitely knows about this topic.
Yeah. Well, if he ever wants to be on our podcast, we'll let him.
That'd be fun.
Yeah. But he's going to have to reach out to us because I don't respect this whole 5 minutes at a time thing. Do you know how frustrating it is to put on a 5 minute long podcast?
You got to be tight.
You got to be real tight. Dude, like, if you're driving, we got to put on another one.
We're like the Hufflepuffs of the podcast game. It's a little bit of Gryffindor mixed in.
Sorry, my parents didn't let me read Harry Potter.
Oh, what? Yeah. You haven't gone back and read them?
I actually preached a sermon on this. Well, not a sermon on this. This is an analogy I used. I was part of that beautiful, beautiful contingency of Christians that did not read Harry Potter. My fourth grade teacher would read Harry Potter at the end of class for the last like half hour, and when I told her that I think it's against my religious beliefs, she was like, okay, John, you can just go to the library. And I would go to the library.
Oh, so this
every
is a W
day
for you.
It was a horrible no, it was terrible. Oh. Because I was too scared to tell the librarian why I was there by myself without my class, so I would just sit outside in the hallway.
Oh,
like,
no.
I got in trouble and I felt so bad. But no, I'm going to read Harry Potter for the first time when A and I have kids.
Do you have any big spoilers? Like,
I think I've got all of them down. I know.
Don't say it though, just in case.
Just in case, yeah. I know a lot of the deaths.
Okay.
I know that Gandalf dies.
When we...
One of them's gay, right?
No, Rowling.
Or did she retcon that? Like, did she say that after the fact?
Yeah, and then it ended up backfiring because she wasn't gay enough.
Yeah, I don't think we can say gay. That might get us like flagged.
I'll say it. Also,
I didn't mean that like in the diminutive term. I just meant like whatever, dude. I don't know why we're still talking.
When Steffi and I got married, we read them out loud together, and that was fun.
Yeah.
You and Annie should do that.
Yeah. Well, I'm definitely going to... I want me and my kids to, like, experience it for the first time. So even they'll be like, what's going to happen to Ron Weasley? And I'm like, I don't know, kids.
Speaking of witchcraft.
Speaking
let's
of witchcraft.
Another heresy.
Yeah. So we're back on the heresy train, boys. We're ready to roll. Roll right off the tracks, because that's what heresies are. And we're going to talk... So if you guys have been following us for a while, we've... really gone, geez. So we did kind of that series within a series where we did the four Christological heresies, which I'm not going to make Thomas name because I know that he'll get mad at me.
I might be able to name them, but when you start asking me follow-up questions, that's where I get stressed.
Things
it's
get
like
rusty.
A freaking ordination exam every time I show up here.
So we did that, and then we did a Pelagianism, which is a banger. Pelagianism is great. No, it's bad. It's really bad. I mean, like, that episode
that was
great.
Yeah,
that was fun. But this one's not good. And now we're going to do Marcionism, which... So Pelagianism was around the time of Augustine, which is after those first four. after like the three of the four, and then kind of concurrently with Eutychianism. This one, however, is actually going to be a step backwards in history. This is a little old heresy by the name of Marcionism. So Marcionism, do you know anything about this, Thomas?
Is it kind of Gnostic heresy?
Surprisingly, yeah. So when I first went into it, I knew a couple of the major points, did not realize how freaking Gnostic this heresy is. So this is a second century heresy.
Was it started by a woman named Marcy?
No, Marcia, actually. No, so it was started by a dude by the name of Marcius. Marcius of Sinope, which I think was a small little town somewhere in Asia Minor. He was, not a bishop, not a priest, just kind of a thinker and I guess a little, you know, armchair philosopher, a very gifted administrator, very good communicator, similar to Arius, which is why his ideas kind of spread as well as they do. And he is going to connect with a well-known Gnostic by the name of Cerdo, which is a terrible name. I just love dunking on these bad names. But Marcius, according to tradition, was excommunicated by his father, who was a bishop. And so he's like, dad, parents just don't understand. Yeah. You know,
sounds like a Disney movie.
Yeah. So he's like, oh, you don't get me, dad. And so he goes to Rome, and he's like, I'm going to tell the Romans all my great ideas, because I have this great, you know, I think I understand the Bible really, really well. And you'll notice that an interesting difference between second century heresy and third century heresy is that in the third century, they're kind of realizing, oh, we need to buckle down. You know, after Arianism happens, that's when the first ever big church council happens, which of course is Nicaea. Like, the church is kind of realizing we've got to be really careful about how we correct these teachings before they turn into these fireballs that just cause all this damage. In the second century, there's not really those kinds of systems of correction, and so that makes it a little bit harder to squish these problems when they come up. Marcius is going to go to Rome, and he's going to share his big cool ideas, and it really starts with his big cool Bible, because Marcius has this idea. Marcius says, you know, one time I was reading through the Old Testament, and I thought, this blows. Like, if you know anything about Marcionism, you would know it as the heresy that basically said the Old Testament is terrible. And there are many historians and scholars who would say that Marcius was an anti-Semite. He was just straight up opposed to the Jews, which unfortunately in Christianity's history, there's a lot of anti-Semitism. So I don't think that's out of the question. But it is fair to say that Marcius just does not see the link between the Old Testament and the New Testament. This is a biblical flaw that I'm sure we see quite a bit today, but he reads
Andy Stanley.
He reads the Old Testament and he's like, this God seems like a tyrant. He seems like a jerk. He seems mean. He seems wrathful. But then in the New Testament, there's this dude named Jesus, and he's just high-fiving everybody and giving everyone like hugs. Like, he seems great. So he kind of forms his theology around this fact that the Old Testament and New Testament don't really sync well together. And again, in church history, not only do you not have a history of councils that are set to straighten out these teachings, we also have canon where everyone kind of affirms the books of the Bible, but it's not been like laminated yet.
That probably needs to be one of our coming soon episodes, because I think that is a real big key to understanding one, kind of how they were dealing with heresy, because they had determined basically what the word of God was and what it said. And the history of, if you thought that it was incredible that all these bishops could show up from around the known world and put down heresies, wait till we tell the story of how we got our canon.
Yeah. And so he basically reconciles this idea that you've got this scary fireball throwing God in the Old Testament, and then this super chill kind of hippie peace and love God in the New Testament. And he says, and he very much influenced again by Gnosticism, which is an episode that we're gonna put out hopefully relatively soon, decides, oh well, these aren't the same God. These are two different gods. And
we
in
do
fact,
like a, just a quick crash course on Gnosticism?
Sure, sure. I mean, so Gnosticism existed before and around Christianity. And it is essentially, so whenever you hear someone say something like, oh gosh, this world just sucks, I just wish I could be a spirit in heaven with God, like that's a very Gnostic idea. And I'm sure you're thinking, well, I think that sometimes, and
too bad.
Well, but really what it comes down to is Gnosticism is kind of born out of this Greek philosophy that says that matter is inherently bad. Right. Matter is it's fallible, it's problematic, it's corrupted in its very essence. It's not something that can be redeemed. It's just inherently broken.
It's like soul good, body bad.
Yeah, the true form of all things is not in matter, but in the spiritual sense. And so that's a big Gnostic idea, and he kind of takes on that too. And he says, oh, well, there's actually two gods. So the story of the Bible, according to Marcius, would go a little bit like this. In the beginning, there was this Jewish God who created the whole material world, and he was an evil God, and we see him in the Old Testament being evil, and he's wrathful, and he's destroying people, and he's telling people to destroy each other, and he's just full of malice and hate and destruction. And then there's this spirit God, and this spirit God sends Jesus to basically destroy the old God who was evil, and the goal of Jesus is to help us transcend this brutal material world and find the spirit, and kind of like transcend out of that into this beautiful, because we're supposed to be spirits. Jesus is breaking us out of our bodies and helping us be spiritual instead.
This is super Gnostic. This just makes me think of just like so many different ideologies from like our own day, mm-hmm. where people are really captivated by some story or agenda or political theory or whatever it is, and they want to cling to it so bad, but they also want, they sense something in Christianity that's true, and so they try to blend them and make them one thing.
Exactly. And you know, it's interesting because a lot of these dudes, and this is something we've said about a lot of the heretics, one, most heretics don't come to just rip up what we know about theology. A lot of times they're just trying too hard to correct something that they don't quite understand, or they overcorrect an existing problem and make a brand new one. And they're also smart. And Marcius was a smart dude, and he, like, understanding the theological implications behind this theology is very interesting, because what he essentially said was that Jesus did not come to satisfy this Jewish system of sacrifice. He actually came to overthrow the evil God of the Old Testament. Like, that's what Jesus's great purpose was. It wasn't to take on the sins of the world. It wasn't to be the Lamb of God. It was to be to overthrow this evil God who's done all these terrible things and created this world that's essentially a slavery world, because it's matter and matter sucks and physical stuff sucks. And so Marcius does something very interesting, which is he kind of establishes the first like front to back canon, because the way that we as Christians at this point in time understood the scriptures were, a lot of it was just books and letters and stories that had just resonated and were traditionally accepted by the people of God. Marcius says, all right, well, I'm going to make my own one of those, and here's what it's going to look like. Oh, I am going to quiz you a little bit, Thomas. Are you ready?
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to give you a book, And I want you to say if it is or if it isn't in Marcius's, in the Marcionite canon.
Okay.
All right. Let's start off easy. Genesis.
No.
Out. Yeah. Jeremiah.
Nope.
That's right. How about Daniel?
Probably not.
That's right. Matthew.
Could be.
It's out.
Out.
Yeah. So he's going to cut out the entire Old Testament, which is a given. That's the evil God's Bible, right?
You know what? Matthew would be a big no because of its connection to the Old Testament story.
In fact, he's only going to keep one gospel, and it's the gospel of Luke.
Hmm.
And the reason is because it's the only one written by a Gentile.
Oh.
Which is crazy because you think Luke still has plenty of references to the Old Testament. So all the Old Testament gone, all the gospels but Luke gone. He goes through the gospel of Luke and he removes all of the cross references to the Old Testament. And then you'd think, well, what about Paul? And this is where I think Marcius's Gnostic influence really comes out, because you'd think that he would throw all of Paul's stuff away, and he doesn't. He keeps 10 of Paul's epistles and then throws away all the rest of the New Testament. Hmm. So in the Marcionite canon, you have the book of Luke heavily edited and then 10 of Paul's letters heavily edited. And the reason why he's cool with Paul is because there's this idea within Gnosticism. This is a whole system of religion that exists outside of Christianity. They believe in this kind of idea of secret wisdom. Like, yeah, there are some people who just get it. Like, it's the secret sauce. Like, some people just understand in ways that the public couldn't. Honestly,
gone on a Freemason binge on YouTube, the Freemasons are super Gnostic.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is kind of a tangent, but you ever heard of the Five Percenters?
That sounds familiar, but I do not know what that is.
Yeah, Five Percenters were kind of like an offshoot of the Nation of Islam. Really popular amongst 1990s rappers like Wu-Tang.
Oh,
they're all Five Percenters.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
So the reason they're called Five Percenters is because they believe that only 5% of the general population is capable of accessing secret wisdom. And 85%...
That's kind of an
attractive idea. Dude, it's kind of cool. And then 85%... are blind to it, and then 10% are those who know the wisdom and are trying to suppress it.
Wow.
And so, I mean, come on, who wouldn't want to do that in Brooklyn in 1994?
Right.
But yeah, anyways, back to this one. So in Gnosticism, there's this idea that you can kind of have secret wisdom that's imparted very privately. It's not something you just plaster on a billboard and everyone knows it. They thought that Paul had that secret sauce.
Hmm.
And the reason why is because Paul, especially when you look at like the book of Romans, says a lot of things about how the law was a terrible master. It was something we had to be freed from. Like in Marcius's mind, Paul understood that the law, as we understand the Old Testament to be, was inherently suppressive. But they wouldn't say that Jesus came to fulfill that with his perfect obedience and his sacrificial death. They would say that Jesus, as the culmination of the Spirit God, came to destroy it. And so the law has zero value because it's inherently not just like an impossible metric, like we would say. They would say, no, it's evil. Like, it's actually wrong.
Hmm. Interesting. So, earlier today I saw a video. There's this, there's a modern heretic named Brandon Robertson, a guy who went to Moody Bible College, and then he came out as gay and has since created an entire, I don't know, ministry wouldn't be the right word, but he's kind of tried to, he kind of poses almost like a theologian, but he's just deconstruction and beyond. I don't know if you've ever seen any of his stuff, but just absolute nothing about what he's doing is Orthodox Christianity, and he's constantly attacking the Bible and certain even, so the video I saw, he was critiquing Paul, and he's like, Paul never met Jesus. Like, he's just this own, like, he comes after Jesus. He's just interpreting like his own thing. And my first thing I thought when I saw that, I was like, what do you mean Paul never met Jesus?
Mm-hmm.
Jesus smacked him in the face, blinded off of him. A horse, and spoke face to face with him.
Yeah.
And then there's other encounters that Paul has face to face with the risen Christ. It's just insane to say that.
Yeah.
But he's trying to like act like Paul is just this heretic who's just running away, you know, with the train and doing his own different thing, when there's actually people like Marcion in history that are just literally making crap up.
Oh, yeah. Like, and so remember, going back to how we define what a heresy is, heresy can fall into either two camps. One, it's somebody who thinks that they're right and is told they're wrong, but continues to go in that direction. That's what Arius did. That's what Eutyches did and Nestorius. Or they do what the Donatists did, and they say, well, I don't care. I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing and evangelizing my little false gospel because I'm right. And that's what Marcius is doing. Marcius is not trying to knock on the doors of the bishops and trying to, you know, get a council to have the church change their mind. He's just sharing his
own thing.
He's a little sect. Like, mm-hmm. he's just leading a little sect and kind of going from there. And man, that the Paul argument, I hear it so much. It drives me crazy. People who will say things like, well, I really love Jesus in the Bible, but Paul is such a problematic figure. And it's like, dude, you have to understand, like, there has never been a generation of Christians, like, maybe I shouldn't say never, maybe like the first half generation of Christianity directly after Jesus, before any of the New Testament writings. But like, there's never been a generation of Christians where you could just remove Paul's presence and influence. Like Christians from the beginning have believed that Paul was anointed by the Holy Spirit to like basically widen our understanding of Christ's work by doing all the theological and practical writing that he did. Like, there's never been a generation of Christians that said, actually, we're going to go in a route that doesn't include Paul. Like, that's never happened, except for dudes like and even Marcius was like, this dude's got it. Like,
yep.
So
yep.
The anti-Paul stuff really does drive me crazy.
It's really lame scholarship.
It's, you know, read the Bible a couple times and, you know, teen group and then left, and I don't know, I'm being condescending. It's not fair. You know, and so I do think an interesting thing about this is, you know, there are people who I've talked to, and I don't think these people are anything but Christians wrestling with a challenging thing, which is like, you know, they're like, oh, I read the story of the killing of the Canaanites in Joshua, and they're like, I'm finding this hard to reconcile with God. And they're not going the Marcion route. They're just like, I'm just not sure how to reconcile this. Like, I do think it's important, and I think that understanding the effects of this heresy makes it even more so, that we need to, as Christians, be able to understand the bridge between the Old and New Testament, because you know, with that Augustine quote that I love so much is, the New Testament is in the Old Testament concealed, the Old Testament is in the New Testament revealed. Like, that idea of, you're in the New Testament, you're seeing like the effects of the Old Testament. When you look in the Old Testament, you really see all these like foreshadowings happen. And, you know, and in our Reformed tradition, we see a lot of this stuff because we understand kind of like the, what is it?
The typologies.
Yeah. Like,
yeah.
You know, Isaac being spared, as the sacrifice, the son of the covenant, but being replaced by, the lamb without blemish who was sacrificed so that we can all be spared, like that pointing towards Jesus. And you know, so many stories in the Old Testament where we can say like we're seeing like a glimpse of what's about to happen.
This is where the doctrine of the Trinity is so important, where when, you know, if you have a problem with God raining down fire on Sodom and Gomorrah,
mm-hmm.
that was Jesus.
Yeah.
Jesus did that. And you need to reconcile in your mind the fact that God is one and that mm-hmm. Jesus is Yahweh, and that all of the judgments that we see throughout Scripture. And I also think that a lot of times those critiques of like pitting Jesus against like the God of the Old Testament haven't even read the New Testament.
Right.
Like, Jesus said some really, really difficult, judgmental things to people.
Jesus spoke more about hell than anyone in the Bible.
Yeah.
Which is scary. But also, and I want to be considerate, because we might have people who are listening who are kind of like wrestling through that. Like, first off, to have a good understanding of the Trinity, you need to recognize that like all three persons of the Trinity, like they don't have opposing or even complementary traits. They have the same traits. The love of the Father is the love of the Son, and the love of the Son is the love of the Father. So when we see the grace of Jesus, he is expressing the grace of the Father. He is expressing the grace of the Spirit that we experience today. And when we see the anger towards sin and the like determination to destroy that which is in and of itself destructive towards good and perfect things, like we see that in Jesus. We see his anger. We see his, like, you know, regardless of how literal you want to call his expressions about hell and judgment, like he's making it very clear that judgment is a side effect of unrepentant sin, which is why he's calling people to receive mercy. And so I think that even well-intending Christians can have this idea that like, oh, well, God is a father, so he's kind of like the stern, mean, judgmental one who's very defensive, but Jesus is like the nurturing, loving, kind one. And it's like, look, we can see those attributes in ways, like, if you want to say those things, that's fine, but don't say they're exclusive to right. each person.
It's not a good cop, bad cop.
No,
scenario,
no, yeah.
Or
and
like dad and mom. Or
right,
like that.
Right. You don't want to do that. Like that, I mean, I feel like we reference a lot of our old episodes quite a bit, but like our Julian of Norwich episode, like, she has this vision of God where she experiences like the maternal love of God, but you would never say like, oh yeah, God is our father, but Jesus kind of expresses motherly love. Like, no, they both have like, they both as God, as beyond human limitations, they're capable of expressing different forms of love that do transcend us. And so it's really unhealthy to kind of say like, oh, well, you know, the Spirit's the cool one and Jesus is the friendly one and God's like the tough one with the leather jacket. Like right. that's, it's just right. really bad theology. I think that's bad theology that just leads to a very stilted understanding of when we pray. Because, I mean, I know people who only pray to Jesus when they pray, and they wouldn't say that God the Father and the Spirit aren't real, but it's like they've built this understanding of Jesus where he's the one that I relate to. And it's like, no, the Godhead relates to you because the incarnation happened. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't have to feel like only one part of God is relatable. Like, that's, you're hurting yourself there.
Yeah.
So
that's good. So what happened kind of with Marcion then?
I try to do a little bit of research on that. It doesn't seem like he had as decisive of a defeat as...
He just kind of did his thing and it fizzled out? Or?
Yeah, so one thing for sure is that pretty much all of the major church fathers in the second century all took turns just whomping on Marcionism. Like you see it in Against Heresies by Irenaeus. Mm-hmm. He spends a lot of time talking down on Marcionism.
Which Gnosticism was kind of like his big enemy that mm-hmm. he took on.
Yeah, yeah. And like I said, they're kind of kissing cousins, Gnosticism and Marcionism. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of overlap there. I was even reading through some of Against Heresies, and almost every time he would reference Marcion, he would also reference other Gnostic leaders because he saw them as very similar. What was it? Tertullian also wrote pretty extensively against Marcionism too. So I think the fact that Marcius wasn't trying to infiltrate the church but was basically leading a counter movement meant that is movement could only be as strong as the people who were willing adherence to it. Yeah. So once that started to fizzle out, it died. But I mean, like we've said with a lot of heresies, I think this issue still exists today.
Yeah.
I think that Marcius, interestingly, really shows how it was not uncommon for anti-Semitism to exist within church circles at the time. I was thinking about this even in the context of the fall of Jerusalem, which, you know, that the big destruction of the temple that kind of solidified Christianity as its own distinct religion to Judaism. They kind of like split down the middle at that time. It makes me think, like, on the one hand, that big catastrophic event gave Christianity its own distinct identifier. On the other hand, that distinction and foreignness to Judaism, which has contributed so much to Christianity, it allowed for prejudice and like malice to like start to exist between the two of them. And yeah, like I said, I mean, Christians, especially throughout the history of Europe, have had, you know, really awful times of anti-Semitism and oppression towards the Jews. And a lot of it was bent around this idea of Jews are subordinate to us because they killed Jesus. And it's like, dude, that was the point. Like, so
yeah, I think with something like Marcionism, you see it eventually lose steam because the biblical story is just that comprehensive and solid. Mm-hmm. Like, that's why we see Gnostic tendencies and Gnostic type ideas like all throughout history up until today. But Gnosticism as like a formal kind of system of thought, or Marcionism as a formal system of thought, just never works long term.
Yeah,
because I think oftentimes the people that tend to fall for these heresies, they just don't know. Like, mm-hmm. They've never been shown the unity of the scriptures. They've never mm-hmm. been shown the unity of the biblical story and how Jesus is the fulfillment
right.
of what God is doing throughout history. And once you see that, then it's really hard to like go back to pitting them against each other.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's a bummer that Marcionism still falls into this same old freaking problem of resenting the physical world and wanting to trade it for something spiritual. Because I think my wife and I were watching this like TV series on Hulu or Netflix or something, and it was talking through some of the doomsday cults from the 1990s.
Oh yeah.
And what's interesting is like
Y2K stuff.
Yeah. It's very centered around that. And I think it was the you have the Branch Davidians mm-hmm. and then the Heaven's Gate, I think. They were the ones that were like Lizard Planet or something like that.
All right.
But like all of these cults that create this like deep reverence for a spiritual transcendence, like, you know, because like they're literally showing what the extreme is when your inner theology is resentful of the physical world and longs for the spiritual world. Like, the extreme conclusion of that is these like suicide death cults.
Yeah,
because they're like, yeah, let's ditch this lousy planet and find ourselves on the fifth ring of Saturn or something yeah. like that.
If I remember correctly, Jim Jones, a lot of his adherents were really poor people mm-hmm. at the time. There was a lot of African Americans.
Mm.
I think people who really had a hard time in life were drawn to, and I don't remember a lot of the distinctives of Jim Jones's. We'll have like a modern hairs or
oh,
we'll
totally.
Have like a we'll have yeah. a cults miniseries we'll do. But
yeah.
like you're right. There is something about that that tends to, I think, attract people where it's like, this doesn't make sense. This can't be the way things are supposed to be, so I'm going to just eject to the spirit realm.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the gospel has an answer for. Like,
right.
Suffering finds its meaning and its purpose in the cross.
Mm-hmm.
And when we are baptized into Christ, then even our sufferings are bound up in his sufferings, and they are given new life, new purpose.
Exactly. Because, like, you imagine if you've got someone who is, let's say there's like a cult, a doomsday cult that pops up right across the street from your church, Thomas, and they offer a traumatized woman who's just looking for something to hold on to, someone who's been deeply traumatized by horrible things in life. And they say, well, your trauma is related to your physical existence, which is inherently bad. And we actually can offer you just an escape pod, just something away from this existence altogether. And then you look at the gospel, something that you're preaching at your church, away from this, you know, doomsday cult, and we say exactly what you said. Your sufferings are not foreign to God. Your sufferings are actually shared in Jesus's sufferings, and there's an intimacy that you can experience with the beautiful creator of the world because he knows what you've been through. And also, we can believe that there's redemption for the life that we've struggled through, and justice for the evil that we've experienced. Like, that is like actually corrective, like beautiful things. It's not just escape pod theology.
Yeah. Yep. It's good news.
It's great news. It's super good. So yeah, but that's Marcionism, man.
Sweet. That was like way easier to understand than like the last two heresies we've done.
Well, dude, that's what I was thinking too. It's like the third century, I was laughing about this because it's like the third century heresies are like, I don't know, man, the Trinity is real, hypostatic union is real, but maybe Jesus's nature was like slightly intermingled, where his spirit was partially his human sense. And then Marcius is just like, yo, what if the Old Testament wasn't real? Like, what if Jews were terrible? And what if like there were two gods and Jesus wasn't even one of them? Like, like just complete Wild West, man. I love it. So
it actually, it's kind of interesting how you see the heresies unfold. I think I talked about this maybe a few episodes ago, but I like the idea that the historicist perspective on like Revelation, where you see, I don't think this is everything that this is trying to encompass, but like when the dragon like opens its mouth and like tries to drown the woman and the child,
mm-hmm.
Matthew Henry says that it's like, that's indicative of all of the heresies that are going to try to drown the church over the first few hundred years.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting. It seems like it starts off with like T-ball kind of, or like coach's pitch. Like, let's see how the church handles this. And like, the God of the Old Testament is an angry Jew in the sky. It's like,
wrong. Yeah. False.
But as time goes on, as the church gets stronger and stronger, they're having to deal with more and more, not less important, but a little bit trickier to discern heresies. And to their credit, they took down every one.
Sure. Yeah. It's a beautiful thing. To be guided by the Spirit, you know, humble place to be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, right, dude. That was good.
Yeah, that was fun. I want to do a couple more second century heresies, I think, because Montanism is another kind of fun one, and there are a couple more. I think we never really did a true modalist.
What about Baptists?
That'd be a five-part series, man. Just kidding. We love all of the Baptists. We don't agree with your view of the covenant, but we think you're still really cool.
We love you.
Honestly, if you were like, hey, we've got a potluck to go to, one's at a Baptist church, the other's at a Presbyterian church, I'm going to the Baptist church.
Yeah.
That's where Miss Jenkins brought out the good mac and cheese.
Some baked beans.
A Presbyterian potluck is nothing but
a
bottle of wine and a pack of cigs.
Mm-hmm.
That's a Presbyterian potluck.
Yeah, that's why they're all skinny, because they don't know how to eat.
Yeah. I don't want to smoke a pipe in a conference hall. All right, well, I think we got everyone mad at us now, so thank you guys so much for listening. If you're not following us online, we'd love to hear from you. We're at Church History, the number 4 chumps on Instagram, and Yeah, give us a follow. We post funny
rate,
memes.
Yeah, rate us on like Spotify, Apple Music, wherever yeah. you're on. Shoot us a rating. We're starting to see. Cool. We're starting to see more people find the podcast like as a resource for like mm-hmm. work that they're trying to find out about someone or yeah. a certain time in history.
I've had some friends from a seminary tell us that our episodes on the Church Fathers was really helpful, and I think you know who I'm talking to, listener, so you're welcome, and keep listening. And yeah, me and Tommy have been talking about some cool things for the podcast. We've been thinking about starting a Patreon where we'd have even more cool content for you guys, so we've got some cool things coming, so jump on the train before it passes you by.
God bless you.
God bless you guys. See ya.